You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host. Today's episode is supported by the good folks at Sacred Blossom Farms. Look, I care about you guys. You tune in week after week. I only want the best for you. So what I'm about to say, buzzwords like organic and all that, you can rest assured. What I'm talking about is herbal teas blended to support health and taste delicious. They literally farm for your health, my health, and the health of the planet. No herbicides, no pesticides, no flavor additives. I had a variety of flavors, my wife and I actually, from Tiger, which uses India's most sacred herb, Dream, which uses an underutilized herb to make you drift off to sleepy land, and Angel, which is basically the daily ritual. The end result is some damn tasty tea, and it's a party in a cup. So put down the Cristal and turn up with the tea. Get yourself some of the world's finest herbal teas grown on an organic farm out in beautiful Buffalo County. You can pull up to the farm. That's right, local listeners. Drive out there in the driftless region of Mondovi, Wisconsin, or visit the website at sacredblossomfarm.com. Listeners of this podcast can use promo code Beethoven to get 15% off your order. That's promo code Beethoven at checkout for all my listeners for 15% off your order. This episode is also supported by Podcorn. Podcorn has finally launched their services, and take it from me, I've signed up since the beta. And when I started this podcast, there are so many daunting things to worry about. Getting sponsors is something that was heavy on my mind. But now I found a portal that makes it easy. Podcorn is a service that connects brands with podcasters to acquire in-broadcast sponsor time. It's revolutionary in the sense that they give brands the opportunity to be part of the conversation where listeners can hear from the brands. So not just pre, mid, and post-roll host read ads, but brand interviews, panel discussions with experts, and professionals who are within the brand's industry. Look, it's relevant, it's informative, and they're changing the way companies and brands interact. So if you're a podcaster, like myself, I don't care if you're a veteran or a hobbyist or you're just getting started or a brand looking to partner up with one, get started yourself at podcorn.com. They're here to support you at every step and ensure you're protected and compensated for the work that you do for brands. And I mean, that's important, guys. So click the link in my show notes to sign up to Podcorn and start browsing sponsorship opportunities today.
It's the Bedroom Beethoven Podcast.
Whoa, you just blew my mind because nobody talks about that shit.
Thank you for this. Like, I was looking forward to this chat, man. I love your interviews.
I thank you for what you're doing. Like, it's excellent. And people can continue to learn the stories of these Bedroom Beethovens.
How did you find out about this? Oh my God.
Having something like this to shed light on us is amazing. Like, we really need this documentation. So people like you are definitely needed.
Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, sound gurus and audiophiles from around the globe. This is episode 56. Another week, another guest. This episode, I'm proud to present to you.
Professionally, I'm known as DJ Rockmatic. I represent a couple of crews, the Beat Junkies, the Visionaries, Cypress Junkies with Eric Bobo from Cypress Hill, and Cron Royale with Buff One, a.k.a. Jamal Bufford, and also Dirty Disco Squares with Prince Paul and Mr. Len.
A legend in Scratch DJ production, a pivotal ingredient to the overall late 90s Cali underground sound. If I use a wide focus lens and look at the culture of hip hop, all roads lead to him. And we deep dive into a wide array of topics such as why you had a breakdance if you wanted to rap. I mean, we're talking Adrian Young, Razzcaz, all your favorite MCs and musicians did it. Guerrilla marketing your music in the 90s, the origination of G-Funk. Man, we get so into the weeds He has to ask me my age because I messed so much stuff up. Look, I know KRS-One is regarded as the teacher, but for my money, it's Rhett Maddock. So thanks everyone for joining us. And real quick before we get into it, if you like what I do, I try to keep the show as ad-free as possible. When they reminisce over you, my God. You can go to patreon.com/bedroombeethovens. It's in the show notes. You can give just a buck or two to help support me. BedroomBeethovens.com is the website. You know, most podcasts don't even have nice websites, so check it out. All the social media channels and YouTube are on there, and you can even write into the show. It's the same song I dance every episode. I'm sorry, I get it, but I gotta let you know so you can access the show. Support it if you choose, and above all, I just hope you enjoy what I do. Dude, Beat Junkies. Are you kidding me? Rhett Maddock's here. Let's get into it. Drop it, yeah. Back on the hip-hop's the DJ. Mm-hmm. It must be pretty somber in LA with the passing of an icon.
Yeah, man, it's pretty rough, man. Before that, I had a couple of friends passed away, even before Kobe right there. So then this is kind of like just LA right now is in mourning right now. This is like, especially, you know, with Nipsey last year, now this and stuff. So
yeah, people don't realize that Kobe was a big hip hop fan. I haven't seen anyone mention this, but he was on a remix to Destiny's Child "Say My Name." He was on a Brian McKnight song. He had a track with 50 Cent.
Oh yeah, when he first came to LA, a lot of people don't know. I mean, if you listen to "Blessings" by the Visionaries, he rhymes about this particular incident where when he first came to LA as a rookie. The Wake Up Show had an anniversary show at the Palladium, and I think Organized Confusion, Wu-Tang, the Junkies were there. I think Visionary, the Alcoholics, and they brought out Kobe to rock on a freestyle session on stage and shit, and it shook everybody out, you know. So like Kobe, yeah, for a hot minute, Kobe was, you know, rookie year, he was like kind of down with the Liquid Crew. Obviously, a lot of people know that he was like. He went on a prom date with Brandy and stuff. So it was that all that during that time and stuff. So, and Shaq just put up, I mean, just recently on his IG that he did a freestyle with Shaq where he's just busting. So yeah, he was pretty nice, kind of pretty nice on the mic. I mean, considering those other songs, he was actually pretty nice on the, you know, pretty nice on the mic.
Yeah. I think Steve Stout wanted to take him under his wing. And at the time he made Will Smith's Big Willie Style that went like right. 9 times platinum. So I don't know. Maybe right. The universe just thought basketball was more of his calling, but a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, man. Like, especially in LA, I think that's why everybody loved him in LA, because he was down. He was just like, you know, shoot. He was like, you know, he was at the time, he was just going everywhere. So people embraced him in LA. It's like he's just, you know, culturally wise and stuff. I mean, outside of LA and basketball, it's a whole bigger thing, but here it's real special because he was down, you know, he was down with the people here.
I guess, you know, you probably met a lot of people while you were working at Fat Beats back in the day.
In LA, we had this, during the 90s, we had this hip hop club called Unity. Rest in peace to Big B. He was like, he used to be doing promotions for Loud Records. And he was actually the first, you know, because of that, he was actually one of the first people to bring Wu-Tang out to the West Coast. I mean, literally during those days, he was like the only one that brought a lot of the East Coast acts along with, you know, having West Coast acts, underground West Coast acts during those days. Like you wouldn't be, it'd be, you know, Wu-Tang Clan, but then you would have the Alcoholics. Then you probably might have Freestyle Fellowship or Razzcazz. You might hire, you know, like Common and the Beatnuts, but then you have someone like, say, you know, Self Scientific during those days and stuff. It was, you know, got to see, met a lot of people during those days.
But I know J57 was interning there, so that's probably how, well, like you and the Brown Bag All-Stars connected, right?
No, well, you got to understand. So Fat Beats started in New York. He worked in the New York store.
Oh, so you were LA.
I was right. LA. LA was more like when Joe Abajian, DJ Jab, when he opened up, he opened up the New York store like mid late 90s, you know, mid 90s. And then he opened up the LA store. And by that time, when he opened up the LA store, you know, he asked Babu to be the general manager. And of course, like beginning, you know, Yeah, it was a general manager, and of course it was a cat named Marsky, and who's a LA local legend. You know, and then eventually, like J Rock, myself, knew Mark, Mark Love, who's a LA local legend, working there. You know, other couple of people. And this is like early, you know, like this is like the mid '90s, the beginning days. When you're talking about Brown Bag, they started working there towards the later end of the New York store and stuff like that, like the 2000s and stuff. So I've actually was one of the for the when you know for LA and stuff, especially when Fat Beats was shutting both stores. I was one of the last OG employees to work there, even though I was like doing stuff with the Junkies and the Visionaries and whatnot and stuff. I just when I have a day off, I go work over there and stuff just because I enjoy working there. But yeah.
I know you made Rhett Committed Murder on your headphones at the Cerritos Mall.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. Well, I was waiting for my mom.
I'm Jack Donaghy, loan shark in the FIFA brothels. Beef and broccoli rocking, oldie and falafel. Scientology, each word is fucking retarded. Rhett-matic on the beat, what the fuck have you started?
Ain't a team alive, though. Alive, no, fuck them.
Self-explanatory. that's where you discovered hip hop, basically growing up in Cerritos.
Yeah, you know, pretty much. I got to experience hip hop when it came to the West Coast during the 83-84. You know, so for me, I started. You know, I experienced it when I was in junior high and stuff, and then from then on, it was, you know, and we didn't even know it was called hip hop. I got to see the birth of. But what was, you know, like obviously hip hop was going on in New York already in the '70s and whatnot, you know, but when it started coming out to the West Coast, you know, in LA for me and stuff, eventually like K-Day started to come on, KGFJ, KGLH, you know, like obviously LA was late, but whatever we were getting was like obviously a few years behind and stuff. So, but yeah, I got to experience with everything, what was going on, you know, eventually. You know, same thing with everybody across the nation, whatever. Rapper's Delight was my first, technically first rap record, but then hearing Planet Rock on a boombox and seeing cats are popping and stuff like that, you know? And you got to understand too, on the West Coast, you know, like popping and locking was already, you know, and even though I didn't know this until I got older, but popping, locking was already in full effect. And that's where on the West Coast side of things, popping and locking is a West Coast thing. And obviously b-boying and breaking was an East Coast thing. And a lot of people don't know that Soul Train was, you know, majority of it was taped on in Hollywood. And you had the Lockers and you had, you know, like, you know, Shabba doing them and Rerun, Fred Berry, aka Rerun and stuff, you know, Funk was big also, you know, on the West Coast and stuff. So there was a little kind of like a street culture also going on the West Coast, but it's obviously a little bit different than the East Coast.
We lost a lot of potentially great musicians because maybe at the time they thought, hey, dancing is going to blow up. I'm going to focus full time on that. One of the members of Brotherhood Creek felt that way. Ty, right?
Oh, wow. You did your homework. Well, see, Ty is my best friend. We grew up in Cerritos. So, you know, like he was always a dancer, but he was also, you know, like he was not really an MC or anything like that. The lead MC, Sean McDuffie, aka the Mac, was the one. He was like one of the best MCs where I was growing up in Cerritos. But before that, he was one of the best poppers, you know? So like, you got to think about it too. During those days, you know, like in the '80s, you were doing at least two out of the four elements of hip hop, you know, me being, you know, Asian or Pacific Islander, you know, a lot of us never really were outspoken. We were pretty much like either DJs or dancer or graph artists. And I couldn't rap for shit. To tell you the truth, I was too shy and DJ and basically being a graph, you know, cause before I was a DJ, I was a popper and a graph artist. And then and then eventually got into DJing. And I was doing all three, but then eventually DJing became more of my calling. And yeah, it was more comfortable because I was a shy kid, but hip hop actually helped me in general, just became, you know, able to find my own voice.
Whose idea was it to put that decal on the back of that Toyota 4Runner in 1995? Your single, Can You Hear It? you know, requested on the radio, requests our single. I mean, talk about guerrilla advertisement. Did that work? Did it create a buzz?
I guess so. I mean, it was different. Well, that was the owner of Up Above Records. If you did your research about it, obviously during those days, especially with Asians, you know, with the mobile DJ scene, you know, like Northern California had their scene, Southern California had ours. When I connected with Kiku, at the time there wasn't that many Asian MCs, and if there was, you know, they were corny. For me to connect with an Asian MC was like, they got to be dope, and not using our, you know, like our ethnic background just to say, hey, I'm an Asian MC. It's like, nah, you know, you have to be a dope MC that happens to be Asian. That's the same thing for me coming up as a Filipino American. Like during that time, it was only just, you know, basically African Americans, Latinos, and, you know, sprinkled with some Caucasians, and, you know, and what people don't understand during the 80s and for West Coast history, Asian Americans were always part of the hip hop culture on this side, mostly as DJs, dancers, and graph artists. And, you know, there weren't that many at the time, not that many MCs, you know, and if there was, it was kind of like, it was kind of corny. And for me coming up, it was kind of like, I hate to say it, on some like 8 Mile steez, kind of like, you know, like where I was coming up, you know, everybody's into it. But when you get the really like to experience the real ruggedness of hip hop, you know, the culture of it, like go to the scene, you had to go to L.A., you got to go to Hollywood at the time. And coming up, the Asian scene was kind of like a bubble, like everybody was into every, you know, whatever was going on, but they would never venture outside. It was coming up during those days, you really had to like really work hard, you know. And going back to your question, is like I've always felt like you know, it's one thing, you know, he did guerrilla marketing. I always felt that you still, you know, to really get your respect, you know, you got to go into those particular events and really prove, you know, like, you know, on some, like, you got to really prove and shit, you know. And then once they see you, you know, you got skills and you represent, for the most part, they'll respect you. But most of the time, they're like, who are you? Who's this Chinese guy? And I'm not even Chinese, but they're like, who's this guy? You know, they ain't gonna let you get in a circle unless you really, but, you know, you really represent and you're really dope.
Yeah, you're a first generation Filipino American. Your mom has been in the U.S. now for over 50 years.
Yeah, my parents came into the, you know, from the Philippines. They moved to California in 1968.
Yeah, that was a few years after the race riots in South Central Los Angeles, known as the Watts Rebellion.
Yeah. From what I understand, you know, they didn't get their experience all that, but it was interesting because like when they moved from the Philippines, they moved there, they came to LA. They first moved to, they went to Santa Barbara. And then eventually my dad found a job over in Hunting Park, which is in East LA. And I pretty much was born in Hunting Park, which is part of East LA. And then eventually they moved to Cerritos, which is a suburb, you know, it's a new suburb. And they moved there in 71, 72, I believe, you know, and I pretty much was born and raised there. But what was interesting about Cerritos was like the first, like for its kind, I just remember growing up multicultural. And Cerritos at the time was kind of special, and I didn't know it until like growing up, like how special growing up there. And it's like, you know, that's why I got exposed to a lot of stuff, especially because of hip hop.
I know Huntington Park, or man, I mean, the majority of East LA is gentrifying. I spoke with Eli from Grouch and Eli. He was telling me he grew up in Echo Park, and if he could afford it, he'd move back. Which is crazy to think that you can't enjoy the neighborhood you grew up in, even when you've had a, you know, such a successful career.
From what I understand, looking at the old pictures and looking at the history, it was a nice neighborhood and stuff. Obviously, as time went on, it became more predominantly Latino and stuff. I guess I don't know if it is starting to be gentrified and stuff over there in Hunting Park. And I mean, they're trying to gentrify a lot of places over there in LA, but you know. There's still pockets where they're not letting, like Boyle Heights. They're really fighting hard not to let anyone try to, you know, move in there and try to gentrify the place and stuff like that. So, you know, it's really interesting. You know, you have to understand with LA, everybody thinks just LA, but LA is just a bit in general, like LA County. It's spread out. It's big, you know, there's LA proper, obviously, but there's within LA County, there's so many cities, like, you know, a couple of cities in East LA, there's South, Central LA, like, you know, Compton, Watts, whatever. There's South Bay. There's like Carson, you know, Carson and Torrance and Gardena. Where I live, Cerritos, we're in a border, we're LA County, but we're borderline between Orange County. We're like next to Long Beach and Compton and La Mirada and Bellflower. So we're like in the outskirts and stuff, you know? So we're in the middle between LA and Orange County and stuff. So, and then you got Orange County itself. And then eventually you go to the Valley, you got to go to the Inland Empire. We're like, LA spread out, man. It's like people don't understand that LA spread out. Obviously, when people think of LA, because of the, you know, Hollywood, that's the entertainment capital.
Now, for that, the beat Rhett committed murder, it only consisted of samples from Adrian Young. Did you know how big he was going to be? Because at that point, you know, there wasn't even the Black Dynamite stuff. And you were also going to do a 7-inch back then that was going to be Adrian Young, yourself, Brown Bag All-Stars. It was your idea, and Adrian signed on to do it happily, but it never happened. You know, just think about what could have been, because this was way before Primo was doing the first Prime album where he only sampled Adrian Young. You did it first.
Actually, they put out the song, you know, but, you know, it was funny because I've known Adrian for you know, quite a long time. I'm very, very lucky to know him, you know, like I've known him as he was a dancer.
Oh, wow. So this was before Venice Dawn.
Oh, yeah, totally. When I was working at Fat Beats, I remember he came by. He was starting to do a documentary about dancers, especially LA dancers. And, you know, it's called Respond to Sounds. It's probably on YouTube. You can Google it and stuff. And he talks about the LA history of, you know, like freestyle dancers, like you know, Soul Brothers, who danced for Def Jeff, you know, Scheme Team, Divine Styler. Adrian was also a polo head. So, yeah, so that's how I know, you know, he was working on that. And then eventually, during that time, he was starting to be a lawyer. The SP-1200 was my first machine ever, especially when they reissued it with the black surface, because the original version is gray. And, man, that cost like 2-3 G's. That was expensive during that time for me, that stuff. But I eventually went from SP-1200 to an MPC-2000. I bought Evidence's old MPC-2000 when he went to an MPC-2000XL. I was on that for quite a while, and then eventually went to Reason. And I've been on Reason. I have Ableton, but man, it was a little overwhelming. So I kind of went back to Reason and stuff like that. And then at the end of the day, I look at it as like, obviously coming from a school where like, yo, whoever, you got to use this, you got to use that. To now, like, it really comes down, it's not what the machine you use or software, it's just the person. If you're dope, you're dope. You know, if it comes out, you know, whatever works for you, you know? I mean, perfect example would be Madlib. You know what I'm saying? So how you gonna say keep it real if you didn't? But if you're, you can, the machine, you can have the machine, but if you don't make dope beats, it doesn't matter, you know.
Yeah, 100%. I think the other flip side too is that, like, you were you recently revealed you were in a studio session when Dre did Animals with Anderson .Paak. Let me ask you, because it's the names that are in the studio that don't appear on the track that are always interesting. Like, you had One Half a Little Brother, you had X to the Z, you were there. What kind of stuff goes on there? Because I was talking to Marco Polo, and he says that he credits you for having a career because you let him into your own studio session.
I was listening to your podcast about that with Marco. Well, God bless Marco. He's my friend. You know, that's my brother right there.
Was he being too humbling?
it's not even a studio session. It was like just what do you call it? It's something at the time, I was living in Long Beach, so I had I had a garage, which was my studio and stuff like that. And and he was staying down the street. I think he was staying at Revolution's house. So this is the first, like, we met the first time versus, because it was a Beat Society that would have Knots, Kanye West, Illmind, you know, whoever was making, you know, just making, you know, dope shit, boom bap shit, you know, and it was making noise also, you know. I found out about it because of OK Player and the message boards and all that stuff like that. So finally came out to L.A. The first one they had in L.A., DJ Khalil from Cell Scientific, Aftermath fame, you know, doing incredible producer. That's my brother right there. They had they had him, Illmind, Babu, and Jake One. The next time they had it, oh, man, they had Marco. That's when I met Marco Polo. Right. They had Kev Brown, Jake, and myself. And tell you the truth, when that happened, I was like shitting pants because, a lot of people know me as a DJ or just only a producer for Visionaries, but not outside from, they don't know me for my beats and stuff like that. So when I got asked to be on that, because the first one, I just DJ. This one, they asked me this time, and I was like, oh shit. In all honesty, I'm glad it worked out that way because, Marco had the heat, I was trying to juggle being a beat, trying to make beats and still be a DJ. So, and I wasn't really prepared, all the beats I had that I played during the Beat Society were mostly going to the Visionary. So I couldn't really give out anything at the time. And Marco had the heat. And basically that's it, man. That's it.
You touched on Key Cool a little bit. You guys are celebrating like 25 years. That track of Reconcentration, where Nishi tells the story of how the U.S. government relocated and locked up over 100,000 Japanese Americans in internment camps. That song is just as important then as it is now with all this political crap that's going on. It's still a very relevant track.
Well, it's crazy because his parents were, he wrote about that because his parents was a part of that internment.
The concentration camps in America were labeled with euphemistic terminology to try and twist the psychology of the public to think that it was okay to put people of Japanese descent away in what they call the camps of relocation. But relocating should be voluntary, yet they were forced in this situation. Even if you were citizens, they were arrested and locked up like prisoners, convicted for the...
So he got to know the history about, he wrote that during the same, when we were making the Cosmonauts album. So it's Key Cool and my, people listening, is Key Cool and Rhapmatic, the Cosmonauts album. It was during the same time that I was doing scratches for Raz Kaz of Soul on Ice when he was working on that. So when Raz played Soul on Ice, and he played it for Key and stuff, Key got inspired from that. And, Raz got, gave us the blessings to do something like that, So that's like, an Asian version of Soul on Ice, if you can say, so it was pretty crazy and stuff like that. So
it's important because in the 90s there were major labels pitching stuff to you that made you feel like you were being exploited or disrespecting you. This predates the Mountain Brothers. I think Booyah Tribe was first, but you guys were like, you were breaking down barrier.
Yeah, I mean, the shouts to the Mountain Brothers, the Chops, and then obviously they were the first one to get signed to a major label, but I think we were the first one to be like independent to officially, get co-signed. I mean, we were lucky, our album got reviewed in The Source and in Rap Pages. That's a big thing to have, to me is like to have Raz on the album, like Raz, this is the time when Raz was starting to blow up. Like, he was starting to be compared to like the West Coast version of Nas, you know what I'm saying? So yeah, separately, because when Key, before Key and I connected, Key was a solo artist and he was also in some other groups. So, he was shopping his thing and stuff like that, and I guess that's what he had to deal with, right? For me, after I left, got my split from Brotherhood Creed, I had to go back to the lab and can really realize what do I want to do? I wanted to make boom bap hip hop. And that was the labels, they wanted more hits and stuff. And I didn't really fit into that.
I think right before Dilla passed away in L.A., I know when he was in L.A., he had a small circle of people that he would hang out with and trust in L.A. We talk about Boom Bap. I think after Boom Bap, there was G-Funk, right? I think it was an overlap.
No, Boom Bap and G-Funk was always in, same thing. With L.A., we listened to everything. Even though it was G-Funk, that was still some hip-hop shit. It's just, you got to understand, we grew up in funk and stuff like that, right? So funk is part, during those time, we listen to everything. You ask MCA, you ask Snoop, you ask anyone, they all grew up listening to KRS-One, BDP, Rakim, and all that stuff. The same thing as they listen to that, the same listen to whatever was going on in L.A. and shit, that was what it was. Detroit was listening to, techno. L.A. was listening to, electro-funk, which is also, we played Cybertron. Clear by Cybertron, which is Juan Atkins, is a really well-known Detroit techno producer. Cats were popping and breaking the Clear. We thought that was a West Coast shit, but we didn't even know that was Detroit. We were listening to everything. I mean, Prince, Hall & Oates. I mean, that whatever was going on, that's what we thought. And we didn't listen to Breaks until later on, until Ultimate Breaks and Beats started selling out here in the West Coast, I mean, to L.A., this guy named Steve Yano, rest in peace, who was a vendor at the Rhodium Swap Meet. So you heard about, I'm sure you heard about Dr. Dre's Rhodium Swap Meet mixtapes.
But check it out. Right about now, Dr. Dre is on the wheels, and I'm about to cold tear shit up.
It was this guy, a Japanese American, selling all these records, and he was one of the first person to get the Ultimate Breaks and Beats out in the West Coast. Dre got those records. That's basically straight out of Compton. Is all Ultimate Breaks and Beats.
Yeah, I thought the G-Funk stuff started with like 213 and all that, or Regulators,
no,
or something.
No, see, everybody only think focus on the G-Funk stuff, but West LA has a lot of history. If you delve in, I mean, because you got to think about it, of course. I mean, everyone grew up on where everything was coming from, New York. See, what people don't understand too, the history of, like, say, K-Day was the first 24-hour AM hip-hop station. They played rap, but they also played everything. They played funk. They played Latin freestyle. They played disco. They played anything that was coming out of New York, but then also was playing here and stuff like that, you know? So we were open to everything. If it wasn't for K-Day, a lot of the New York artists wouldn't be being broken out here and stuff like that. You know, like, you ask De La Soul, like, De La Soul got broken out in K-Day over here. Same thing with Queen Latifah. Same thing with, you know, BDP. I heard about the stories. L. Cool J coming to L.A. the first time, and he was wearing red, and he's in the Crip, in a Crip area. I'm sure you heard the story how everybody had to test De La thinking that they were soft because, you know, they're hippies, quote unquote. But nah, like, Maceo and Dave were like handling people and stuff like that too and shit like that, you know? And they got the tour with NWA and shit like that. They being all tight, you know? Like, there's a lot of history a lot of people don't know about it. They're just known about the, cause what's given on the video. So I don't know if you don't mind asking, how old are you?
Oh no! When someone asks your age, it's always like, "Oh my God, this guy." But I mean, I'm 34, and when I was getting into music, it was before the internet kind of unified the scene. So I grew up on like the Manny Fresh Bounce Southern hip hop era.
Right. I mean, there's like I said, even the history books. There's not a lot of. I mean, it sucks because like there's not a really proper thing for West Coast history, you know, especially for LA. Or even Frisco or whatever, whatnot. I mean, there's just recently Red Bull did something on Uncle Jam's Army, which is dope, you know? But there needs to be more extensive history of on LA, at least. And, you know, and you have to think about it, too. Like, down south was even still, even for the bounce music, you know, stuff like that, you know, cats were like, you know, like, I didn't know DOC was from Dallas. You know what I'm saying?
Same way a lot of people don't realize that Tupac is originally from New York.
Oh, I know that. MC New York. You know what I'm saying?
Everybody associates him with the Dr. Dre California era.
Right. But I'm saying from my era, we all knew the history. We all wanted to know what's going on and stuff like that. You know, like for me, I was ahead. I was a nerd when it comes to hip hop. Not only for New York, for LA. And when it started becoming more bigger, you wanted to know different regions and stuff like that. You know, come on. Yeah. Devin the Dude was from the Odd Squad. If you listen to Odd Squad, their shit was boom bap, you know, on some New York shit.
My gal, we've been apart for a while. Yeah, I miss her kissing, I kind of miss her smile. But I'm the one who fucked up, walking around with the big head. She made me feel like I had a gold-plated dickhead. But I was trying to fuck everything that moved and breathed. She never checked or suspected there was something up a nigga's sleeve. Yeah, my baby, she trusted me. She never even cussed at me, except that Friday night when she busted me. Loving over you for sure, pussy trying to get some old pussy. You'll end up with no pussy.
No, doing some extensive history, you talk to Manny Fresh. Dude, his biggest influence is Mantronix.
Which is where J. Dilla got his producer tag from. I mean, that's where I know about him.
No, but not even that. But Mantronix is like if you listen to Mantronix, dude, he was like ahead of his time and stuff. Every New York and LA was like on, you know, and in between was like, and Europe were like on big on Mantronix. Mantronix was like, dude. Come on, like, I mean, Cold Getting Dumb, Just Ice was one of his best production work. I mean, the stuff that he was working like in doing stuff, we were just like, oh my gosh, you know, he was ahead of his time and stuff like that. It just shows you just how much influence in one way or another and stuff like that. You know, 3 years ago, got to meet DJ Manny, you know, got to meet Manny Fresh. And I remember Manny Fresh before he was with Cash Money as like, you know, he had a record out. It was on some, almost like on some Miami based shit. It was like a, DJ Manny Fresh and Fred, it was a, oh man.
D and Manny Fresh, y'all. Great, great Burger D and Manny Fresh, y'all. DJ Manny Fresh, y'all. DJ Manny Fresh, get with it, get stupid.
You know, and he was cutting it up, you know? That's all I know about Manny Fresh and stuff like that. So it's like, I knew about Manny Fresh before he, Manny Fresh of Cash Money and stuff like that. A lot of people don't know that 2 Live Crew is originally from California.
Oh, man, so many good stories here, man. I hope you really enjoy podcasting and you continue to keep doing it. I know you're starting to get guests on now, so I hope we can keep sharing this knowledge.
It's pretty cool. To tell you the truth, so the Bee Junkies, it's crazy. Once our 20-year anniversary happened, we didn't realize how much fans are still checking out for us. Like, especially when we did our L.A. show for their 20-year anniversary, we had both older and younger generation, like, crowds at our show, and it kind of blew our mind. Like, the Junkies never blew up. We were still DJing. We probably wasn't as active literally as a crew, but we were still hanging out and stuff. But it was like, once the 20, you know, like, hey man, we're going to celebrate 20 year. Let's do something. It's like, all right. So, I mean, you can follow, you know, the Visionaries on Instagram at the Visionaries. Some of our listeners doesn't know are not familiar with the Beat Junkies. We're a DJ crew based out of LA, but we're LA and San Francisco. We were known as, one of the three major turntables crews during the golden era of turntablism during the 90s with the Invisible Scratch Pickles and the Executioners. So, we opened up a DJ school called the Beat Junkie Institute of Sound, located in the city of Glendale. This year will be our third year we've opened. So, knock on wood, you know, it's our way of giving back to the culture and, you know, expand more on the community for the DJ community and stuff, you know? So instead of always complaining about it, you know, we decided to do something about it. For more information, you can go to beatjunkiesound.com. We also have a digital record pool, which is, beatjunkies.com. So it's a digital record pool that's curated by us. So anything that we like or people that we'd like their remix or edits, you can go, you know, DJs can sign up for there. We also have an online DJ school, beatjunkies.tv. That's beatjunkies.tv. Go to, you know, for anyone that wants to learn, you know, that can't go to our school but want to learn, they can learn at our, you know, they can learn online and stuff. We also, you know, do online sessions on there as well. We also have a radio station called Beat Junkie Radio, which is a 24/7 radio station on Dash Radio. It's an app. Yeah, you can download the Dash Radio app. You can also go to like online, dashradio.com/BeatJunkieRadio. I actually have a show on there. It's called Soundcheck. So it's kind of like on some Stretch and Bobbito wake up show, Friday Night Flavor Steez. I'm playing all the boom bap hip hop shit, you know, everything from Griselda to Blue and Exiled to Bugsy Nino to Ito to Muggs, anything that I think is dope raw, you know, that's that shit. So
you wear many hats, man. Well, thanks for, you know, gracing my podcast with your presence between school, gigs, touring, and Lunch with Mom on Sundays. I know time is sparse, man. So I want to recognize that. I appreciate you swinging by, man.
I'm honored that you, you know, want me to be on your show. So thank you for having me. I don't know. I mean, hopefully, your listeners enjoy this particular episode. So I might be just rambling here and stuff, but thank you for having me.